wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 336 with our boy of summer, Scott Thompson. You may know him as one of the iconic members of the fantastic Kids in the Hall. Before we get into this episode, I just actually do want to give you a content warning. Max Fun and I, and all of us, of course, know that mass shootings continue to cause untold trauma and heartache in the U.S., and by the way, worldwide. We recorded this episode before the recent events in Dayton and El Paso. And around the 23 minutes and 40 seconds mark, Scott starts talking about his personal experience surviving a school shooting. It's an extraordinary story. He talks candidly about his experience and how he continues to process it, including the fact that he's recently started talking about it in a stand-up and in a screenplay that he just finished. But because of that, the interview contains some, I admit, very dark humor. That's one way of whistling in the dark, as it were. And again, you know I'm extraordinarily emotional if you listen to this podcast, and very empathetic. So I do not take that lightly, but this may be difficult for some people to hear. It may be harder to listen to in light of recent events. I just think it's really important to have this kind of open discussion and for folks to hear Scott's adult perspective about what it's been like to go through life with this trauma. That said, I love you guys. If you want to sit this one out because hearing this kind of discussion is going to do you more harm than good, we absolutely understand and support that. If you want to skip this part of the conversation, again, you can look for about 30-ish seconds and head to about 37 minutes. Okay, guys, enjoy. I'm going to get into this. I'm going to play this game with you at the end, and I don't know if you have any idea what it is or how it works, but I'm going to control it and keep you
safe. This is good. I feel much clearer now.
We just had a nice catch-up.
We had a catch-up.
A very quick
catch-up. Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. Just State of the Union.
Cleared the air.
As it were.
A little bit.
A little air clearing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me make sure. I'm not even, like, I was so excited to see you. I didn't even do my job and make sure our levels are good. I'll tell you what. They are good.
I'd say, like, if I had, good. Like, a car and my oil needed to be changed.
And that's what we
you
did. We
looked inside.
Job.
We did a quick lube job.
Yeah.
There was some very old oil
there. There was a little bit of a smell and a sound that we couldn't identify.
So we drained it.
Now you're purring like a kitten.
Yes.
Purring like a kitten.
Yes, I am.
I say this as a person who is ready, willing, and able to make car metaphors all day long, and yet I have zero strong feelings about cars in
me
general.
Me too. To me, there are blue cars, red cars, two doors and four doors, right? Convertibles and...
Yeah.
Hatchbacks.
Yeah. Listen, that right there, that's impressive.
I don't even know. I was going to call them a hard top.
Uh-huh.
Are they called hard tops?
Which one? The non-hatchbacks?
Non-convertibles or hard tops.
That makes sense.
And what's a hatchback?
Hatchback is, it's sort of, instead of a traditional trunk, you open it up and it sort of swings out like a DeLorean door,
right.
But in the back.
Yeah.
I do have a hatchback.
Oh, you have a hatchback?
I do.
Did you grow up with a, what do they call them? What are the long ones called?
Station wagon?
Station wagon.
I didn't.
I did.
You did grow up with a station wagon?
Mm-hmm.
Was it like the most
with
cliche?
Paneled,
that's exactly what I was going to say.
Wagon.
The most cliche. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't that look like wood?
With five boys.
Well, there you go.
And then when my father...
What were they supposed to do?
And then my father, when he... After the last kid, my mom's fifth kid, my dad was about 42. I guess he had a midlife crisis.
Oh, no.
He sold it, and he showed up with a green Mustang.
No, he didn't.
My mother was furious.
Did he have any sense at all, the cliche he was living out?
He had a comb over and a Mustang. Yeah. And then he started wearing cowboy boots.
Oh, my God.
I think everything but a mistress, because I really don't think that. But
right.
I remember my mother was furious. I remember when he showed up with that Mustang, we were so thrilled. I mean, it didn't last long. And
she make him get rid of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it didn't last long. And the next thing you know, we had a station wagon again. But I imagine.
Wait, how old was he?
42.
See, that's what is so crazy is that, you know, being now being the age that parents are when they have midlife crises that we as children see, that's startling and very scary.
It is. Because I don't think a 42 is old anymore now that I'm well past 42.
Not at all.
And by that time, my father and mother had they had five children.
Right, that's so crazy. When did they start? When did they
first? They started having babies.
Yeah.
I guess she'd be 24. Pretty traditional.
How far apart are you guys in age?
Well, the oldest, it goes from, I guess, quite a spread. The oldest, let me see, 15 years.
Okay.
I guess she had kids for 15 years.
Ooh.
Her last kid was 40. So 16 years.
Was it, I'm trying to think of how often like five kids is purely a choice and not like we don't practice birth control.
Oh, but
I think it's time. You know what? Let's try for a fifth.
Well, I think the fifth one, I mean, was a mistake, or we don't really know. It's either a mistake or my mom did it on purpose.
Oh, okay.
Now, my dad, they're old, and my mom's got Alzheimer's, so I can say these things about her now, and she's not going to correct me. Yeah. But there's a part of me that thinks that she just stopped taking the pill because she wanted another baby.
And do you think that she was the kind of person who felt most comfortable identifying as a mom? And so it gave
oddly
her...
enough, no.
Wow.
No, that's the interesting thing. I think if my mother was a woman today, she'd have gone the career route.
Yeah.
And but I think she was, when she started having babies, she's very competitive. She wanted to be a real competitive mother.
Right.
So she wanted to have the most. and she there was a part of her that really took perverse pleasure in them all being boys.
Wow.
And I think she saw it. So she did see it as a career, but she would say to us quite often,
my God, it is a career. Raising five children.
Oh, it is a career. And my mom would say she would say, you know what? If I had it do over, I wouldn't have had all you buggers. Buggers. Buggers is what you little buggers. And she'd tell us that, like, oh, God, I would have stopped it. I don't even know if I had any kids.
Yeah.
She'd have been a career woman. But she did her best. But the last one was at 40, and I think she was trying for one last chance for a girl.
Mm-hmm.
She really wanted a girl. She never grew up with girls. She was a twin, so she had a female, her female twin, identical, mm-hmm. and a mother, no father. So that's all she knew.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, she loved men because she was raised by her extended family, cousins and uncles and all that sort of thing. So she was always around boys.
Yeah.
She loved men, but she didn't understand them really in a way. I mean, she understood them in a way that a super flirtatious woman does. Like, she, mother, very flirtatious, loved men. She definitely knew how to play men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even her own children.
Totally. I remember when my mom started, when she started getting demented, she was just, very, mom was a very waspy woman, very correct, very proper, but we always knew that she loved sex. I mean, sometimes she would just say, like one time when I was like 16 or 17, we're at the table, she's writing thank you notes, which is her profession, and she did a lot of that, folding laundry and writing thank you notes, and she just looked up from the laundry, from a note, and went, I've always liked sex, and then went back to it, and I went, okay, and she goes, and then she go, I've never had, your father and I have never had a problem in that department. And back to, thank you, Mrs. Mulyneaux, for that lovely casserole you brought. So things like that. And then once the dementia happened, I guess all those breaks failed.
So she was just speaking her mind left and right.
Say things like, one time I remember very clearly, I guess a few years ago, like a Christmas dinner, and she just went, oh, I always loved it when they would bring the bull in to impregnate the cows. And I'd be like, what? She'd go, oh, my sister, she didn't like it. But every time they'd go, Barbara, they called me Bob then. That was her nickname, Bob. Bob, the bull is here. And she'd race out to the barn so that she and the hired hands would let her watch the cows being impregnated. Because they rent the bulls, right? Yeah. They take them from farm to farm.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have a big stud, and she could not get enough of that stud.
That is so crazy. Yeah.
So who knows what went on, but she would just say things, oh, I love the hired hands. And you're like, oh, God, what was going on?
Yeah. You don't wonder if your mom ever,
cheated?
Played around, yeah.
I do wonder, yes. I think if there was one of them that had an affair, it would have been her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had an affair with his cowboy boots. That's about it.
Yeah, I honestly don't think my father did. I mean, sometimes I think about asking him, because we could do that now.
Yeah.
And I would have probably asked my mother before she slipped into the real darkness. And then, but my father did something very stupid. I was very angry at him. He got rid of all of her love letters and all of her correspondence, which I really wanted to go through.
Yeah. Did he tell you why?
No, he just said it wasn't for you. It's not. But I'm the gay son. I wouldn't judge her the same way my straight brothers would.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
I think if there was anything like that, that would have really upset them. Mm-hmm. But I never had a problem seeing my mother sexually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. I think straight boys have a real problem seeing mm-hmm. their mothers that way.
That's interesting. To be honest, I never thought about that. I never thought about how your image of a mother or father could be altered by your sexuality. Yeah. But that makes sense.
Like, I had nothing invested in her being like a saint.
Right, right, right.
Or a virgin.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't have cared if she had been a whore before she got married.
What Freud wouldn't have known what to do with like having a real conversation with someone who didn't actually, in his mind, quote unquote, want to sleep with
his mother. Couldn't shame me by saying, your mom's a slut. Well, maybe she was. I didn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah.
So no, I would not have had any. I don't think I'd have problems with my father. I tell you, though, I would probably have a difficult time if I discovered that my father had sex with men.
Yeah. That would
really throw me.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, what? You what?
Would it kind you of treat go me against? That? Yeah, I was going to say.
It would make some of it. Some things would make sense. Mm. Some things would make sense. Like, my oldest brother is convinced that my father is something like these
Where
bisexual.
Do you fall?
Second oldest.
Okay.
I don't. I think he just does it to bug me. It's funny because he's straight. He bugs me, the gay son, about it. Because I guess for me, I'd have to go through, I'd have to look at my own childhood and go, oh my God, then why did he treat me so badly? And then I go, oh, that's why he treated me so badly. Then I'd have to, and I've already forgiven him, but now I'd have to, maybe it would help me. Hmm. If there was something to it, you know? I don't know. I don't believe it.
So as of now, he treated you poorly in comparison with your straight brothers?
He treated us all terribly.
Oh, okay.
But he really was hard on me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was hard on me.
So if it turned out that there was some sort of self-loathing going on, although it's arguable that anybody who treats anybody like shit is self-loathing.
Well, no.
But it would be a different kind of identity crisis.
But in those times, you didn't have to be a closet case to beat your gay child. I think it was considered quite normal.
Right.
I don't think like beating was considered normal, but corporal punishment certainly was.
Right.
And I certainly don't think, I think back then, if someone thought that the man had a gay son, I think society would have definitely looked the other way if that child was being abused, because I think society at the time would have thought, well, maybe it'll beat the gay out of them.
Yeah.
And I have a joke, and I just go, well, it didn't. It just made me like it rough. But, you know, right now we're pretty good with my father. I'm pretty good with my dad. This is another thing that makes my brother think he might be gay. When he turned 90 this year, we asked my dad what he wanted, and he said, well, Cher's in town. We're like, yeah, I really want to see Cher.
Wonderful. So, oh, you told me this. You told me because he got to go. I won't
and
spoil
met
it.
Her.
Yeah.
She
came in and
she kissed him.
Yes.
On the mouth. She came out of her dressing room and she said, where's that handsome man I'm supposed to meet? And my dad said, I'm over here.
He knew exactly who she must mean.
She came over. She gave him a kiss on the mouth.
My God.
And she goes, how you feeling? And he went, much better now.
Oh, my God.
And then she
God.
Kissed him again.
That's a pretty great story.
It is, and it's actually one of the best things.
I felt kind of ambivalent about Cher until you told me that story. And then I was like, I guess I love
this
crazy lady.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
They treated my dad like such like a hero. And here's the funny thing about my dad. I mean, I honestly look at him and went, no, he just really loves that woman.
Yeah.
She's not just a gay campy icon. She's a beautiful woman.
Right.
She's a super talented, gorgeous woman.
Right.
And to my father back in the 70s, she would have been exotic.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, half breed.
Yeah. She really leaned
right?
into it.
Armenian. She
yeah.
did lean into it.
Yeah.
Long black hair. My mom was like a freckle faced, you know, redheaded Colleen type. So, no, I think he just truly, truly loves her. He has a scrapbook
Amazing.
With her. And I just think, you know what? I think some men just love Cher.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And
that's true. They can't be like that. There's right? a you fall into a once you become a gay icon, you fall into a pocket of camp.
You're still a
and
woman.
No straight, yes. No straight person can be attracted.
Exactly.
To
you. Yeah. Exactly.
It doesn't work like that. Shouldn't have to.
It shouldn't have to at all.
Yeah.
But that was it. And I couldn't go to the. But the sad thing was, I couldn't go to it, which was really tragic. I think the only thing I could compare it to is the time that Bruce McCullough got to hang out with Liza and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just
doesn't seem right.
No, that doesn't seem right. Really, Eddie wasted it. I'm like, you did. Yeah. I hung out with Liza all day. You bastard. I know.
Oh, Liza. Well, when did your dad know definitively, like, yes, my son is gay versus my son is effeminate or whatever? I mean, I don't feel.
Well, no,
I know, but like that doesn't.
I'm not really effeminate.
I think I read that.
Gay when right. I'm relaxed.
Yeah.
But I tried very hard to be a tough kid. So that's why I was always doing everything. Well, they found out when I told them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was 23.
Okay.
24. He disowned me. They disowned me. And for about 6 months, and then I slowly, but up until this, still my whole life, my parents never ever asked me about man or partner ever.
Yeah.
Still never. You just make peace with it. You're like, well,
don't
that's
ask,
their,
don't tell. But their own little don't ask, don't tell policy.
Basically. And they accept it, and that's fine. But they've never, my father, they never asked about bringing anyone home or would you like to be with someone? Never. To them, I think it's actually, for them, I think it was kind of, it was, I think they were pleased that I never really did. I did bring some people home, but not in a million years.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't, they just really didn't, they weren't equipped. But then afterwards, they accepted it. They had to. I went on TV and came out, so they kind of had to.
Right. But if he was worse with you, when you were younger, do you think that he was sort of anticipating finding out one day, or was it
maybe
wasn't it, or was it just that you were obnoxious in a different way?
Yes,
than
I
your
was
brothers
obnoxious.
Were, and
I was obnoxious.
Like that.
I was the kid that always I fought him all the time, and I was very rebellious, and I wouldn't. You know, like I wouldn't take no for an answer if he told me to do something. I go, why,
right?
Why does society say you have to do that? I don't go along with that. And like, I was lippy.
Mm-hmm.
Lippy.
Mm-hmm. You were lippy. So,
lippy. Did they say lippy anymore?
But I don't think so, but lippy.
Lippy.
We got to bring it back.
Lippy. And I was the most lippy kid. And when my father would beat me, I would continue, and I would keep up a running commentary throughout it, shaming him.
Ugh.
Which would drive the beatings and make them worse.
Yeah.
I would be like, you really? That's what you do? Good for you. You're going to get an award for being Father of the Year. Smack, smack.
Oh,
keep it up, buddy. That's what fathers do. Smack, smack. So I would keep it up.
Yeah. Is that... I don't... Like, there's so much I want to ask about it yet. I don't even know how to put it in context. But... Because that seems like such... first of all, it makes
from another time.
Well, from another time on multiple levels, certainly the idea that he would just continue to do that and all that kind of stuff. But there's something almost like a literary figure about that response.
Mm-hmm.
Like many of us in that situation would sort of hope that we would be crazy enough or lippy enough or, you know, self-righteous enough, indignant enough, scared enough, whatever's driving that to respond that way. That's how our society thinks of as like a brave person almost. You know what I mean? Like, I know this is going to get me more, but I'm just going to point out that you are a nightmare even while you're, are you a big man now? You a big
man?
That's
exactly it.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's rather than just cowering and crying and being like, please, daddy, please, daddy, please, daddy. And that's a totally normal response, by the
way. Normal too.
Yeah, to cower in the corner and cry.
Yeah.
But that defiance it feels like that feels like I'm not saying again that it's right or wrong, but that's taking a kind of power.
Yeah.
That not all of us would
do. I think it defines my whole life.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Like where I just go where I'm very built. To be mistrustful of authority figures.
Yeah.
And I always know that authority figures will turn.
Mm.
It's probably not a good thing, but I What are you going to do?
I don't know.
But I'm very defiant.
You might be the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, I was very defiant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
You wept as we crafted the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
Yeah. Dude, like, he forgives Darth Vader. Lisa still love you, yeah. Annie.
You gasped out loud at the shocking twists of Face Off 2, Faces Wild.
He takes his kid's face.
What?
Now we're writing an entire screenplay week by week on Storybricks Season 2, Heaven Heist. Hey folks, Freddie Wong here with some exciting news about Storybreak, the Writer's Room podcast where three Hollywood professionals have 1 hour to spin cinematic gold. We're shaking up our format by turning Heaven Heist, one of our favorite ideas we've ever come up with on the show, into a full screenplay.
Heaven Heist is an action comedy about a crew of misfit gangsters robbing the celestial Bank of Heaven. Think of Coco meets Point Break.
Join us as we write this crazy movie scene by scene and get an inside look at the screenwriting process on our podcast Storybreak every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Canada. I grew up in two places. The first 9 years, North Bay, which is a small town in northern Ontario, like idyllic.
Yeah.
And then we moved down south when I was nine. South. I guess everything in Canada. So, okay, let's say Canada's the fridge.
Well, you didn't move
I
to
moved
Alaska.
From the freezer to the crisper. So we moved to the crisper.
Got it.
But I was born in the freezer.
Yeah.
But moved to the crisper, southern Ontario, Brampton. And
also a small community.
Yeah, it was. Now it's not. It's a very big place now. Outside of Toronto, but a small town at the time. And that was when I was, that was my real, but that's where I was really formed.
Yeah. Brampton. That's where you became an adolescent with hormones and.
Yes.
Questions and
yes,
yeah,
and a bike
and a please
banana
please
seat.
Your next one of my show. I want it to be hormones, questions, and a bike
and a bike
and it'll be about your teenage years.
Yeah.
So what? How much freedom did you have? Are you one of those kids like I was that like you know?
Absolutely.
We all say right up to a certain point.
Yeah.
Even kids, even people who are much younger than me, but I still feel like there's a cutoff where. I've sort of found the sweet spot where suddenly kids aren't telling me anymore or people younger than me aren't telling me anymore. Like, oh, we'd go out all day. Nobody cared where we were. No one was asking any questions. Yeah. You came home at a certain time.
Well, my joke is that it didn't matter. You know, they kicked you out of the crack at dawn and said, come home when you're bleeding.
Yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah.
We had enormous freedom. This is the one thing I think about young kids today. I feel bad for them. I feel like they need to be rescued from the clutches of their parents. These ridiculous helicopter parents need to back the fuck off before they ruin the generation. I mean, it's really...
But hasn't crime gone down? I mean,
yeah, that's what's weird, is that we're living in the safest period in human history.
Yeah.
Yet we're behaving like we're at siege.
Well,
weird.
It's a control thing, right? And I think it's especially, and we don't have to go down this road for any length of time, but, you know, when you think about, like, people are now afraid to send their kids to school, which is supposed to be this place where you learn and you're protective and you're with your peers and you don't know, you can't control that or you fear that somebody is going to pull out a gun, it does seem like it's more about what... Everything that I can control, I will. So the chances of you being abducted on a walk from school, if we get to the point where it's like it's more likely you'll be in a school shooting than get abducted walking to and from school, I don't even know what. But maybe there's like these sort of responses to.
But you know about my history, don't you?
About what?
You know my history about that, don't you?
A little bit. Well, yes, but I don't know if you want to get into it.
Well, did you want to talk about, because I think
can.
You do.
Yeah.
The shooting. Is that what you're asking about?
Wait, do I know about this?
You don't know.
I don't know.
Well, I was in a school shooting.
You were?
Yes.
No, I don't know this.
No, I thought that's what you were getting at.
When you
16.
Were 16.
Very funny that you, and it's very funny that you're asking this
now. But you haven't talked
now.
About this in a show I've seen. Like, you haven't talked about this in a place where I would have, like, where you're like, wait a minute, how can you not know this?
I just started to do it in stand-up.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't heard you talk about this at all.
I just started. Actually, the very first time I started doing stand-up was that when I was in San Francisco with you a year ago.
Yeah.
And I did one set, not where I was doing the buddy show.
Right.
And I did up, and I did my first bit about the shooting.
Yeah.
You know, when I was six, and it's funny, last night at 2 a.m, I finished my screenplay, which is called The Very Long Weekend, that I've been working on for many, many years.
Oh my,
and I feel like last night I finally cracked it, and I'm ready for people to read it. And it's a high school coming of age story and wrapped around a high school shooting. I was in a shooting when I was 16.
I did not know that happened
first
when you were 16.
Modern North American high school shooting happened in my school, in my class.
What happened?
May 28th, 1975, 11:38 a.m. Kid behind me brought two guns to school and shot 16 people, killed three, including my teacher. And it's a thing. It's one of the things that's haunted me my entire life. It's an event that I continue to go back to. It's an itch that I've never stopped scratching. I was 16 years old, and I had never seen guns before. I'd never seen a dead person. I'd never seen anything. I didn't even know this sort of thing happened, and then it happened.
Like, I can't. Oh my God, yeah. That's crazy.
My first joke about this is I talk about it. I'm very quiet about it, and I go, you know, when I was a kid, 1975, 16 years old, and it was a high school shooting, a massacre, and 16 shot, three dead, which today doesn't sound very much. I'm almost embarrassed with the puny death toll. But you know what? You work with what you got. I never talk about it because... you know, it's too traumatic. Well, not because of the shooting. I've dealt with that years ago. It's that when you do the math, you'll be able to figure out how old I am. and I can't live with that trauma. But that's what my new show is going to be about.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. And it's even my PTSD, the routine, the thing I'm going to be doing for Earwolf, it's wrapped around the two major events in my with cancer and the shooting.
Yeah.
And
it was a kid who sat right behind you.
He sat behind me. He lived down the street from me. It was my English class, and I was late, so I was racing for class when it happened, and then it all erupted, and I ended up hiding in a class with a bunch of other kids and a teacher for about 45 minutes until we were rescued. And so I go back to that all the time. And every time I see something on television, I don't like Gilroy yesterday. I don't look at them anymore. I'm so calloused in a way. I look at it and I go, okay, and then I move on.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. It's not that it's too traumatic for me. It's just I just don't want to. I also, when I high school students, I go, to think that I was such an anomaly as a child, like what I went through, you think no one should have to go through that. And to think now that literally there are tens of thousands of children who have been through this now. There must be.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there must be. And I'm thinking, wow, this is why this show is important for me, because I'm going like, well, because I think, well, it can, I'm basically going to say, you'll get over it, but you really won't.
Well, yeah, but I think,
but
think
that's okay.
That is a big deal to have somebody who's been there and come this far. I mean, obviously Columbine kids are a certain age and they're doing what they're doing and they're, you know, whether they're talking about it or not.
I'm trying to get one of them for my podcast.
But the fact that you've lived this much life in between.
Like I've really survived a lot of things.
Yes, you have.
And so I look at it and I go, well, I'm obviously a tough nut.
Yeah.
And I'm full of scars. But, you know, my joke is that it's all right that I keep throwing in jokes. But I'm at least saying that I'm not pretending that I came up with them on the spot, at least. Yes.
That would be the cardinal sin.
Because it's like,
right,
you know, because you've got a pretty sexy scar on your arm that we need to talk about.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Unless you don't want to. But I'm fascinated by scars because, I mean, you know, I've got some big ones too. But they're sexy. They get you laid. Emotional scars don't. They just make you better in bed.
But you want to find a way to convey that before you get your clothes off. How do I let this person see my emotional scars to prove that I'm going to be a great lover?
It's
how do I get
I think
that across?
It's true.
Yeah.
You go, sometimes I'm so good in bed, people go, what happened to you? You're too good in bed.
Spill it. Let me hear it. Oh, my
but
God.
But it's true. So, because when you talked about you know, you wanted to talk about high school. And, well, I guess she probably wants to know about the shooting.
No, look at me. I'm not. I couldn't be less exploitative. I had no idea. At best, I was like, you know, if the only thing I thought was like, well, I definitely have talked to you about your dad and stuff like that. And I thought, you know, that was probably not an easy time. But I certainly had no idea.
Grade 11.
No idea.
Yeah.
That's I mean, that's.
And it's very, it's very.
I can't comprehend it. I mean,
well,
I can't
it's so many things
imagine.
About it that are so big for me because the teacher, she was very young. She was 26. Margaret Wright was her name. She was pregnant. She'd just gotten married. It was her first year teaching, I think. So she was, we were terrible to her, but I was her best student. It was English. And she was the first person in my life to encourage me as a writer. So it's a big deal. I think about, I'm at the stage in my life where I look at these things and I go, what did that imprint on me? Like, what does that do to a child when the first person that takes an interest in you is murdered? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was such a bad kid. Like, I was smart, but I was always in trouble. I never shut up. It's even during the siege, I never shut up. The teachers would be like, shut the fuck up. There's someone out there. And I'm like, yeah, blah, 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 blah. I chattered. I was a chatterbox through the siege.
Yeah.
Kind of explains things about me, I think.
But also, like, that's a coping mechanism.
It is my coping.
To be honest with you, I'm the same way. And I really do feel like it has saved me in situations where if I have the ability, first of all, to express anything, but also because it means I'm not catapulted into this catatonic place where I'm afraid I'll never come back from, like my mouth just won't open and words won't work anymore.
Yeah.
So it's that burbling out. But if that also gets me any kind of connection with another person, whether it's that they want me to shut up or they're interested or they're doing the same thing, it like tethers me to something that's outside of myself. Because this place is really scary, she said, pointing to her own chest. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's something about that that...
Well, comedy, and you're always, when you're chatting, you're always trying to seize on something funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, totally. When I get any accident I've been in that I've had to go to the hospital or anything, I am so focused on trying to make the person laugh who's with me that, but I'm, and I say it, I'm like, listen, you're going to have to put up with a lot of really bad jokes because this is just my way of coping with this. And, you know,
this modern notion that a lot of people have bought, which is that comedy can't touch everything. That's such nonsense. Everything. There's not a single thing that is beyond comedy's reach.
Yeah. Have you found that people who are the most uncomfortable with the darkest humor you have are the people who haven't gone through it, and that the people who have gone through it are like, thank God, thank you for making a joke about this? Because people who haven't gone through it assume they're protecting the people who have.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh, the intentions, I appreciate the intention, but why don't you let that person tell me I had no right
to
say
that? And they're the ones that are the scolds.
Yeah.
They're always scolding you. I'm like, but you've never been there.
Yeah.
So you don't know what that world looks like.
Yeah.
So you should shut up. You should let us scarred people make jokes.
Right.
You should let us make appalling jokes because that's good for society.
Yeah.
Because this is terrible. I wrote this joke last night where the prince, and I don't remember if I saw it, if I actually said it, but in my screenplay I do. The principal comes on, and this is true. He was really upset. He was crying, right? I mean, didn't make us feel very good.
Right.
But my character, I don't know if I've said that, whispers to the kid that they're hiding with, well, and he's making a speech, but he's weeping. I go, well, it's certainly, he's no Churchill.
Oh, my God.
And I remember, this is true, and I'm ashamed of this, but I'm going to tell it anyway. There was a kid, there was a girl who'd been wounded that we were taking care of, but it was a very small wound, and it could have been, and I thought, I wasn't impressed by it, but I was probably quite jealous, because I was like, oh, she's going to get a nice scar, but she's not going to die. She's not going to lose any functions.
Right.
It's not going to, you know, hurt her for the rest of her life. She's going to have a nice scar on her arm, much where yours is. And I'm like, oh, God. But she just got winged. And I don't think, I didn't say this, but my character in the screenplay goes, are you sure you didn't just get scratched by your cat?
God forbid.
My character's so jealous of her.
You know what? Again, but that's the kind of thing that people get uncomfortable about, because it's very hard to admit that most of us are in some way, it's just varying degrees,
yeah.
Looky-loos, and we're... what seems to me our very nature mm-hmm. is we put ourselves at the center of the universe mm-hmm. because we have consciousness. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows why we have it. I mean, if you have a person of faith, obviously that's you think that's why. Mm-hmm. But you know, on a scientific level, they haven't been able to sort of explain consciousness, which maybe that does mean there's God, whatever. But we relate everything back to ourselves because that's the only consciousness we can ever experience is just inside here mm-hmm. rather than like, and then I went into Scott's brain and body and mind and I could feel him feeling this.
That might be why I'm so screwed up. I gave my first interview at 16. Want to hear my interview story?
Please.
It's fucking hilarious.
Please.
It's so funny. I'm coming out of a funeral.
And this is after the shooting. You're like, no, this is unrelated.
Coming out of a funeral with a bunch of kids, one of the kids that was killed. And the reporters were all outside, right? And one of them comes running up to me, right? And I go, and the reporter goes, what's the mood in there?
Oh, my God.
What's the mood?
What a gift they gave you.
What's the mood in there?
What a weird gift they gave you.
Here's how I end. I'm this little kid, and I went, no comment! And I walked into a tree. And I've been pretty much giving that interview ever since. No comment, I said self-righteously. What's the mood in that funeral for the teenage boy that was murdered?
Oh, my God.
Quite upbeat, actually.
Oh, my God.
See? Oh.
What a moment.
But I knew what that was like. So I look at a lot of these kids and I go, they're basking in the fame.
And also, they're kids.
They're kids.
I don't understand. How are you supposed to feel? Like,
you're supposed to. Look, our school jacket sold out that year. You couldn't get our school jacket.
Yeah.
Everybody wore that jacket because everybody was like, you went to Death High? You were, right? So we were stars. We had a telegram from the fucking queen, okay?
Did you really?
Yeah.
A telegram.
Telegram from the queen on our bulletin board.
What did it say?
What's the mood
over there? Stop.
We're all perplexed by the situation that is unfolded in that colony that you call Canada. Our hearts and minds are with you.
Oh my God.
In this terrible time.
Oh my God.
Queen, the Prime Minister, President of the United States. Boom. Because it was so unheard of. We were the front page.
I just keep forgetting that the Queen has anything to do with Canada or had anything to do with Canada. I always forget that.
I'm so old now. This will freak you out. When I was a kid, we didn't have a flag.
Really?
No. Canada got a flag.
I'm surprised they didn't make it your high school jacket.
It's true. I think it was 1965. In 1967. But I remember as a little child, when I went to school, the first few years, there was no Canadian anthem. There was no Canadian flag.
I mean,
there was a picture of the Queen in the corner and a Union Jack.
Wow.
This is not that long ago.
No, not at all.
And we sang God Save the Queen.
Wow.
I mean, I could sing every word. God Save the Queen. And then I remember when we got the flag in the late 60s, I remember as a kid going, I don't like it.
Yeah.
We don't need it. I was very British.
Yeah.
Like I like ginger beer and I knee-high socks.
Yeah. What kind of a sense did you have of like French Canada and BC?
Oh.
Like it would be like you're in the Ontario area.
First part of my life was in French and English Canada.
Oh, was
Northern
okay.
Ontario is both.
Got it.
But I didn't. You didn't. They had their own thing.
Like Ottawa is like across
Ottawa's
the river
both.
From yeah right.
Hull.
Yeah.
Ottawa is a bilingual town. Northern Ontario is very. The French were like, you know, when you're a Canadian, you have to be in a weird way, tri-national. Let's say if you're an English Canadian, you have to understand the French Canadians, and then you have to understand the British and the Americans, maybe quadrinational.
I was going to say, God, the Americans probably too.
Yeah, but you really have to know you have to know American culture.
Yeah.
And you don't have to know British culture the way you used to, but they did when I was young. And you had to know French culture. But French culture was more foreign than in many ways British culture and American culture.
Hmm.
But I felt, as a child, I felt more attuned to the Britain, and then as I've grown older, I think it's Canada's story. Canada's grown much closer to the States, yeah. But now we're pulling apart again.
Right.
But French Canadians, there were lots of French kids in the North, but I didn't, we had television back then. Half the day would be French, half the day would be English. And they would play programs where the first half of the program would be, like children's programs back then when I was little up north, the first half would be French and then the second half would be English. Hmm. But you didn't really notice.
Interesting.
But we weren't bilingual.
Yeah.
I mean, I can speak it, but I would not call myself fully bilingual.
Yeah.
But you were always afraid, much like the Irish would have been back then, you were always afraid of the country breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so, which as a child was exciting.
Right.
I didn't understand what that would mean.
Right.
But ever since the referendum, that's sort of gone. The thought of Quebec separatism now seems absurd.
Mm. Do you think that they feel that way too? I don't know.
I do.
Yeah, right?
Well, I do, because I know that when I go to Quebec now, I don't feel the same tension that right. I would have felt years ago.
Right.
Young French people, they're much more modern people now. They're much more international people.
Did you ever get a chance to have a smoldering affair with a Frenchman who was like, oh, we don't want to be... Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that was not... You were not deprived of that.
Oh,
too,
no. So. That's how most English-Canadian boys come of age.
Amazing.
They go to Montreal and get laid.
Really? I'm so satisfied
very
by this.
Common. Yeah, my first... I had a French boyfriend. It was very... It was sort of like, tick. French Canadian boyfriend, tick.
Yeah.
And mine was black and French, so I got to tick two boxes
sure,
at once.
Sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, well, thank you. I didn't have time. I didn't have time to waste.
That's right. That's right.
I had to. You got to have two boxes, and we're not interested. I'm not interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here's the thing about this too, and the way that the two countries, America, United States, and Canada, see the world. Like, you guys, you see French people and French culture as kind of effete and ooh la la, right? The French male's kind of effeminate. The French people are like surrender monkeys and all that sort of thing in the war. They're considered effete and too
well, the most
fancy.
The most cliche version and the most simplification would be that Americans are dogs and French are cats.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like that sort
that
of.
That is it.
What,
but
yeah.
In Canada.
But no, those swarthy
it's
Québécois
different.
Are like.
It's the opposite. Yeah. French Canada is actually the dogs were the cats. They're actually the masculine part of the fulcrum.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's the English side which is considered the female side of the
yeah.
fulcrum.
I think that's fascinating. Don't
yes,
you?
I do too.
Yeah.
Even like, so when the way the Americans think about French people is completely opposite to the way I think of French people. I think of French being dirty, hairy, smelly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I totally get it.
But yeah. And even English people too, like Americans see English as that way, but that's not okay. Like I think of England, I think of them as kind of rough too, like
mm-hmm.
Cockneys and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think of them all as wearing wigs and
right.
high heels and all
right,
that.
Right.
But that's an American thing too
yeah.
towards most European. It's like this.
Well, it's the frontier, right?
It's the frontier.
It's the we got out of there because we're yeah. a bunch of scrappers.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
And you didn't negotiate your way out of it like we did.
Right.
You fought right. your way out.
Right.
We were like, we have a lot in common.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about what we have in common. We behaved like lesbians. You behaved like John Wayne.
Oh, my
like
God.
Straight. You're a straight male.
Oh, my God.
We're a lesbian. Am I wrong about that?
That's amazing.
Consensus.
That's amazing.
You know what? There's a group that hasn't been heard from.
That's
canon. I hope this is going into your act if it's not already there.
No, but that's good.
I love hearing you talk about
it. I love that. I always think of Ken as a lesbian. This is this is like a straight male.
It's so funny.
And so you got to deal with that. Like, and that's why when I look at the, I'm not sophisticated politically. I see things in a much more like kind of spiritual way, or like I think of countries as animals or people.
Yeah.
And so like I think about like the American, your dilemma right now, I'm going, you're never going to defeat Trump unless you realize that you've got to appeal to some of the things that he puts out there. Because you know what? If you go too far left, it's just not going to happen. So I think I see America in a clear way. Like, well, you're going to have to pull away from some of those because you're not going to win.
Do you feel that you're unique in that way, or do you feel that those are conversations that do happen across the border in Canada, that people are like, why aren't they understanding that?
I think so. But Canada's a socialist country, right? Like, and so I think that's partly like some of my beliefs here. People are like, whoa, that's a little crazy. But I'm not an American. And I'm a born rebel. Like, I'm like, you know, it's like that old thing when they said at Brando and the Wild Ones, what are you rebelling against? What do you got? But I'm pushing against a different... I come from a socialist country, which has no show business. So, of course, I'm going to have a different way of looking at the world.
And then, of course, I just wanted to be Canadian because I loved the French language, because that was like the one thing my mom and I connected on
French?
When I was little. I mean, I...
Petit peu?
So... Oui, oui, un peu.
Oh, mon Dieu.
J'ai un bon accent.
Oui.
De temps en temps. Mais when I go there and I speak this well...
Tu n'as pas beaucoup des mots.
Right. So then people are like, ah, vous parlez français. Et c'est bon de vous voir. Je me dérange pas. And I'm like, plus lentement. Yeah. But then someone just made this joke on stage at a benefit show I was at, which is a guy who... I think he might have majored in Spanish. I wish I could give him credit. I can't remember his name. But he said that he's got a great... It was the first time I ever heard this articulated, which was that he's got a great Spanish accent. Mm-hmm. And he is, you know, he looks Mexican enough. Mm-hmm. And so when he's down there and he speaks, people assume that he's Mexican. Mm-hmm. And then when he... tries to tell them that he doesn't, mm-hmm. he's saying it so well that it is as if you are with a person in America and they say, hey, Scott, how you doing? And you go, oh, I'm doing great. I went to the laundry store. And they go, I'm sorry, could you speak more slowly? I don't speak English that well. You would be like, you're fucking with me. I'm listening to you. You have a perfect accent. Clearly,
your accent's too good.
That's how sometimes it is in France if I'm really on a good day.
But
I'm
probably not in Quebec.
Not at all. I don't know how to... Yeah. I have my one listener, Pierre Jerome, who is French Canadian, and he will from time to time, either on Twitter or in an email, correct me on some things that I've said. But
hello, Jerome.
I love it. But yeah, so I wanted to be Canadian because I knew that they had French and English.
Mm-hmm.
They had Anne of Green Gables and they had the Kids in the Hall. I mean, honestly, that's like what I was like. Those are the things that mean the most to me right now. Yeah. As a teenager, I was like,
are you watching the new Anne of Green Gables? Anne with an E?
I haven't been able to.
It's wonderful.
I know, but I'm so attached to Megan Follows and Colleen Dewhurst and Richard Farnsworth.
Oh, I know Megan Follows.
I'm just like, those are, they were so real to me.
Well, that was great.
You know?
Those are great books.
They're wonderful books.
They're wonderful books.
They're wonderful books. They're really, really special.
Yeah.
So.
Now they'd say she was a boy.
Oh my God. Yeah, probably. Probably.
When she hits Gilbert she smacks him with
so satisfying.
The tablet.
So satisfying. So,
but it's true. But the thing is about Canada that you're missing is that we don't have show business like you do.
Right.
There's no Hollywood. And that's what I love about this country.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things I love about the States, but God, I love Hollywood.
Yeah.
And we can't do that. We're too fair.
Hmm. Interesting.
Right? Fairness, interestingly enough, is not compatible with showbiz. Art becomes fair, you destroy it because it's not given out. It's not fair. And that's what worries me about the trends that are happening right now, where I think, look, a lot of American people in art business are like, we want to be just like Canada. I'm going, well, you don't really, because you write yourself out of a job.
Yeah.
You're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Because this town thrives in unfairness.
Boy, doesn't it?
And capitalism.
Yeah.
And elevating people. in a way that's not socialist and not fair. So you should be very careful.
Mm, God, that's so interesting. It's like you're an interesting friend of mine that I enjoy talking to. It's almost like that. I had a friend who was Swedish and was raised in Sweden and then came when his parents divorced. His mom was American. She came back out and he went even to the U of A, but then he moved back to Sweden at a certain point. But he was fascinating to so many of us, speaking of wanting to be special and being a kid and what are the things that are, you know, make you different. But he carried a briefcase, which, by the way, I don't think that many Swedish kids carried a briefcase. But like, as long as he was, I love you, Jonas, if you're listening. But he was like, I'm already different. Why not carry a briefcase?
I love that.
And he would walk around with this tape recorder, this like, you know, auto tape recorder that he would press. And he would record stuff for his best friend, Sigge, who was still back in Stockholm or in Sweden. And he would walk around and like interview people. And, you know, we had this idea of this like magical person living across the ocean that was his best friend who's getting this all these tastes of American culture. But even then, Jonas was so smart and highly analytical. And he would deconstruct what was going on in American politics and stuff, even at like age 15, in a way that was so intimidating to me, because I couldn't imagine having any kind of outside perspective about what it means to be American.
Well,
and he continues to be fascinating for that.
Well, it is hard for you guys because you're not given it. You're not taught it in school. You're not raised to look beyond your borders because you have so much.
Right.
That's part of it. Like, when you have a country which has every kind of climate, every kind of topography, every kind of people, all in one place, why would you go anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
When you come from a frozen wasteland like Canada, you have to leave. You live in a vast nation with only 30 million people. What are you going to do? You got to get out. And half of them are French. I'm not writing them off, but you know what I mean.
Right.
But I meant that, you know, you share that vast land. It's a very different way. You have to get out.
Yeah.
Like, almost all Canadians have a passport.
Did you feel that, I mean, whether you could articulate it to yourself as that or not, as a younger person, did you feel like I'm the only one in my family who feels the pull to do and be different or to go somewhere? Or did you kind of all feel that way?
No, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did feel different with my brothers, definitely. And I wanted out quickly. Okay. I thought that I wanted, not that I didn't love Canada, but I knew I had to get out of my small town. I had to see the world. I wanted out of the. And when I was 18, I got picked to be on an exchange program. I lived in the Philippines for a year, and that changed my life.
My goodness.
So that was a huge game changer for me.
Was it specifically the Philippines that you wanted?
Or no.
Was it like you're going to find out?
There were 14 countries that, it was a program called Canada World Youth, and they would basically choose like 500 kids, and they would separate them, and all kinds of kids. You had to represent different parts of your country, and then they would pair you with a person. There were like 14 countries involved, all third world countries, poor countries, and you would be paired with a person from that country, and you would spend half the year in your country, in a part of the country you weren't from.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And then the second half, you went to their country and you lived in their part of the world. And the thing is, it's not like the Peace Corps, very Canadian. There was no, the only goal, this is so beautiful, was to foster understanding between the first and the third world. You didn't go there to build latrines.
Right.
Or any of that.
Administer vaccines.
You weren't there to be a white savior.
You didn't.
You were just to learn.
Wow.
So it was almost an entire year. And that changed everything for me. I just went, oh my God, we are the same. Oh my Lord. Because it's one thing to think about it on paper.
Yes.
Right? But it's another thing to have it right in your face where you're like, oh my God, I can't look away. We're the same.
Mm.
Right? Because it was a very, very white, middle class town, not now, but when I grew up, there weren't very few people. The big racial divide, it wasn't even a racial divide, it was an ethnic divide. It was between the Anglos and the Portuguese, which were not even considered white at the time. Of course, now they do. And look at the shit we've been. Look, I hope you're happy, Portuguese. Now no one wants to be white. Ha ha. Portuguese and Italians, you fucked up. You fucked up. Don't you think they wish they were not white now?
Oh my God.
They fought their whole lives and now they're like, why did we fucking do that? We'd be so far ahead of the game.
As the door closes. Yeah.
But that was it. And so I got adopted by a family of 15. I lived in a hut with no electricity on a rice paddy.
Is this the same for your the person you were paired with? Did they also live elsewhere in the Philippines, or did they go back to you?
Mine was different because I had to have different people. My first partner, I don't know what happened. There was a mistake, and I couldn't get him for the second part. So the second part, I had a girl. And I went to her family in the north. But no, and it was actually in her part of the city. She went to her part of the country. I lived in her part of the country.
Gotcha.
But the part of the country in Canada, I lived in northern Alberta. And we were Joji, his name was. Joji Gayaranod. And we lived with a Ukrainian family. And we were cub reporters on the Bonneville Nouvelle.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was you'd love this, too, because of your love of French and stuff. This is a weird part of the country. Northern Alberta. It's so strange up there. It's French, it's English, and it's Ukrainian. They literally, people speak Ukrainian on the street.
Wow.
Like they're not ashamed. But that was it, and then I went to the Philippines, and this is like 1979, the Marcoses, you know, a dictatorship,
yeah,
phenomenal.
It's amazing that exchange could happen.
Well, imagine today. Could imagine young people today going, "We're gonna take your child, we're gonna put them in a fucking
North Korea, you're gonna go
where there's no electricity or running water, and there's an active guerrilla war going on. Not gorillas, guerrillas.
Mm, correct.
And there was. And we're going to keep them there for a year. And some of them might come back, some might not. But they're going to be better for it. Your kid won't even walk to school nowadays. But man, once again, back to what we were originally talking about. Lucky, lucky, lucky.
Yeah.
But absolutely, if my parents knew what happened over there, holy shit. I mean, I'm amazed that I got out.
And
alive.
How old were you when you did that?
18.
Okay. So you had already you'd already
finished high school.
And been mm-hmm. at the shooting and all that kind of stuff that.
So I was prepared.
A series of experiences that the average.
Well, I think a lot of, I think that shooting thing in some ways, in a weird way, in a strange way. This is a very difficult thing to talk about, but I'm going to. Because I like talking about difficult things. It kind of set me up for a life of adventure. Because it's interesting, because I've been chasing that feeling for my whole life. Not the feeling of what happened, survival. Does that make sense?
I think that makes absolute sense.
Because nothing I've ever done, no drug, no sexual encounter, no trip, nothing, no performance has ever touched that feeling of surviving.
Have you seen, did you ever see the movie Fearless?
Yes.
Because that's what it's about. Obsessed with that movie when it came out. Obsessed.
I became so cavalier, so reckless after that.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us did. And in so many ways, like I've had at least 9 lives. And I think that's part of it. I go like, well, you just can't kill me. And that's, I shouldn't do that because that's arrogant. And God doesn't like that when you get arrogant. If you know what I mean? If there is a God, I'm not going to be arrogant about it. But I do think.
But also with all the stuff that you've gone through, aren't you entitled to have that, point of view?
Well,
In a way,
arguably, through magical thinking, I am.
Yeah, through magical thinking.
Yes.
Isn't magical thinking?
Well, it's not logical, but some of my friends go, why would you go to it? Because I love to just travel to countries that I don't know and just plop myself down and then without any plans. And friends are like, why would you do that? I go, well, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Because the world, I guess I've always known that the world is dangerous from day one.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where you are. Like, I mean, I think that's one thing. When I was a child, I grew up in an idyllic kind of, you know, like Happy Days kind of a town.
Right.
And it didn't matter.
Right.
It still didn't stop the fact that a kid wasn't going to come to school and shoot it up.
Exactly.
So for me, I look and I go, well, darkness is everywhere.
Yeah.
Because there's light, so there's darkness.
Right, right.
Because every room has a corner.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think that's, I do think of the world as a battle and dangerous, but I'm not bothered by it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it has. It makes.
I'm not paralyzed by
it. Makes
it
perfect
at
sense.
At all.
Let me just to dig a little deeper maybe into that. Do you feel like you've expressed that through relationships as well? Do you feel that there's a fearlessness to relationships, or do you feel that there's something self-contained about your bravery or your sense of
that I don't
like,
need anyone?
Yeah. Is that?
Oh, now you're really.
Uh-oh.
You're not. You weren't happy with ripping the Band-Aid off.
Oh, no.
You wanted to rip the scab off, and then you wanted to poke at it with a needle.
The problem is that you speak so mellifluously about it all, and you're circumspect about it in a way that makes me feel like it's not dangerous territory or that I'm not being disrespectful.
No.
So it's hard not to because you have such a great perspective on stuff. It's hard not to want to say then, well, how do you feel about this then? If this, then what
else?
I really don't mean to prod.
I've had relationships over, but I've never had one that lasted for a long time. I've never really made one work for a long time.
Right.
And I don't know what that is. I don't know if I ever will. It's painful. And I wonder why. And do you think, and are you kind of, are you saying that because I didn't trust people? Is that what it means?
I didn't have a reason in my mind when I asked it at all.
That I think eventually they'll turn on you?
I don't know. I really don't know. Because I could also see it just being that it's not about trust, that it's more about that you have a closer relationship to yourself and your mortality than other people who are sort of looking to tether themselves to the earth in a different way. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing, even if that were true.
Well, that is, I think.
Do you know what I mean?
True. Like, for example, like at my age I'm at right now, almost everyone is confronting their mortality, but I'm not. Because I already did it a long time ago.
And more than
I did it at 16. I did it at 18 when I had encephalitis. I had another thing. I did it in the Philippines. I did it with cancer. I'm a gay man.
I was going to ask
did
you,
it
I was going to say,
my
did,
whole
did
20s,
you have, yeah,
of
did
course.
You look around going, all right,
so
when
like,
am I going to get the positive
oh, people
test?
Are like, oh, now that you're in this age, people are going to start dying on you. I go, you mean like
then
when I was
that.
In my 20s?
Yeah.
No, it's going to be a lot easier.
Yeah.
So in that way, I think in some ways I'm going to be, in some ways I might get away with, I won't have to confront mortality as much as people my age are because I've already confronted it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think I did make a decision, maybe not consciously as a young person, that I wanted to have more than anything an adventurous life.
Well, I'm sorry that didn't work out for you.
Yeah, it's true.
It's been such a snore.
I really did. I wanted an adventure. I want to be like David Niven, The Moon's a Balloon. That's the kind of biography I want, where it's just one madcap adventure after another, one crazy love affair. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
One in a guerrilla war, then a civil war, then a love affair in the middle of a war. Yeah.
But that goes back to what you were saying about
happened.
The survival, you know, and wanting to. I mean, I think on a very basic level, there is this sort of sense of a shedding of some sort of skin. Like, well, that was the skin that experienced that. And out of necessity, I move past that and I grow this new coat. You know, mm-hmm. I've just moved from skin to coat, whatever.
Yeah.
Just bear with me. Maybe you grow fur one time and then your next adventure, you're naked. And
yeah,
then
exactly.
The next adventure, you have scales.
You're a slippery
so
otter.
You're a lizard yeah. person. Then you're a slippery, slick, oily otter. You know, but like to have those, to feel those... Those kind of that sense of like something new growing, you
I
know,
do like
the
that.
Like a wildfire, like
yeah.
oh, the wildfire at the
oh,
time. Everyone's like, oh my god, this no. is so like you know, you sort of think of the worst,
yeah.
and then you have to have the experts say, no, this
it's
is
good,
it's good.
Like, we need it.
Not to say that everyone should flip their cigarettes out into the desert,
right.
but that there's you know when they occur naturally, that there's a reason for it, and that there is this
and
sort
let's
of
be honest,
growth. You know,
someone throwing their cigarette out the side of the car is also natural.
Well, that's humanity.
Right.
Yeah.
So
Is that
they always
is
count
that,
on us?
Is
to
that
throw
truly
our
less
everybody.
Natural than a rogue lightning strike?
Right. I mean, no.
No, I don't blame the cloud. I don't blame the smoker.
Yeah. I kind of do blame the smoker.
Okay, I blame the smoker because I don't want to lose my double wide. Look at me. I got all classes. I know. There was no need for that, Scott. No need. But, you know, so in that way, like, I mean, I'm going, what the hell? How did I end up this age and be alone? Well, I mean, it can't have all been an accident.
Right.
I'd love to have someone, but I also look and I go, well, I'm not, I don't look back and go, oh, what a waste of a life. Not at all.
No.
But I do think that's a problem today. I think people have gotten way too safe, happy. You have to let people be free to screw up and to hurt themselves. And we can't put all of society in a car seat.
There are things that I've gone through that I find myself wishing I would have gone through earlier. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think...
Like what?
Well, I mean, I guess because I was a kind of a fearful kid, and then I had the good or bad fortune of not having a whole bunch of stuff happen to me, that I... It's like, well, I'll use this example because it's again, this most sort of simplistic, like French cats, American dogs metaphor. But I was never stung by a bee when I was little.
What?
I was never stung by a bee and I was afraid of bees. And I became terrified of bees because the further away I got as a person from never having been stung, the more I thought I probably am allergic. I'm going to have some sort of reaction. It's going to hurt so bad.
I'll have to have an EpiPen.
Yeah. And so I had just, I mean, I don't want to say I like mythologized bees to where I wouldn't sit at a picnic table if there were bees, but I was very, very uneasy around bees because I just had no relationship to it. And when I was in my late 20s, I finally got stung by a bee.
Oh, lucky you.
And everybody who's listened to every episode of my podcast knows this because I know I've brought it up more than once. But my first response was, thank God I finally got stung. Yeah. And the second response was, oh no, female bees die when they sting you. That was so pointless. And I felt so bad that this little bee had given her life to protect what? She was in my car. I was getting into my car and she stung me on the neck. No one won in that situation. Like, oh good, you protected the queen. Where's your fucking hive? You're in my car.
Were you driving?
I felt so sad. No, thank God. I was just getting into my car and I felt something weird on my neck and then I just got right back out and then there was a little bee already kind of writhing on my car seat and I was like, oh no, that was so pointless. But
did it react badly or was it just a regular old bee sting?
It definitely hurt. Yeah, you know, I got dizzy because, of course, your adrenaline's like pain. And it was right near my jugular. So it kind of, you know, zinged me. And then I, you know, put some stuff on it and then I was fine. And then I suddenly had no problem being around bees because I was like, oh, I know what that is. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like,
well, yeah,
big and little things. You don't wish trauma to happen on younger people, but there are some things that I wish that I wouldn't have had to be afraid of bees that whole time if I had just been stung by, do you know what I mean?
Did you ever break bones or anything? Because
I've had
two broken wrists, a broken arm, and a broken elbow.
Yeah. Because you know you can break and heal. And that's the and I was a kid who just kept not ever having, I mean, I would have lots of, like, I fell off my bike and I had scrapes and I was clumsy.
In fact, I kind of fetishize healing in a weird way.
But I think that makes perfect sense.
I'm obsessed when I have a cut. I just can't stand, I can't stop watching it heal.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by all of that.
I
always know it will happen.
Yeah.
Like even with cancer, I went, that's a big cut and it healed.
Yeah.
And I've got a scar and I'm scarred from it, but I killed it. So it's weird. Like, I guess it's like, I think we do children a real disservice by protecting them too much.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Hello, I'm Mujer. Jansa Fagari, and I play a bunch of characters on Mission to Zix, an improvised science fiction podcast on Maximum Fun, and this is our incredible sound designer, Shane.
Hello.
Now, Shane makes it possible for me to play 1,000 billion characters in our galaxy.
Such as the Bajarian Jane, Ship of the Stars.
And the Enforcer Droid, prepare to eat pancakes.
And wait, let's get dusted up, baby.
An Emissary Turk Mannequin. Hey, I just got another M.
And the Horrible Wife.
Oh, also there are 5 other cast members, and we'll give them just all a second to say hi.
Hello.
Yeah, that's enough. Okay, so the season finale of Mission to Zix is coming out next week, so it's the perfect time to dive in and catch up with our intrepid crew as they explore the Zix Quadrant. So give us a listen to Mission to Zix on Maximum Fun.
All right.
Okay.
MASH.
This new game.
Mansion, Apartment, Shack, House. Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you for 3 things in these different categories that I'm going to give you right now. And then we have this sort of eeny, meeny, miny, mo process by which I then give you your future. I tell your future. And it's going to be full of goodies because I'm just asking you for things that you like.
Okay.
For example, I'm going to ask you for the first one, let's do 3 places and times that you can travel to. Nothing bad's going to happen to you. You're in a safety bubble.
Okay.
So you get to experience the world in a way that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to.
Okay.
3.
3 times?
Yeah, so you give me 3. You'll end up with one of them.
Okay. Well,
but it's 3
one
options.
Of them would be, I don't know what it's called. I don't know if it's the Jurassic era or mm-hmm. whatever, but it's the era when human beings mm-hmm. were here and they were still coexisting with Neanderthals
mm-hmm.
and there might have been some dinosaurs left around.
Great. Okay, yeah. Great.
So very, very early.
I think you just described some measure of northern Alberta. I'll let you decide who's who.
Yes, I did, actually. You know all about Northern Alberta and all the dinosaur bones. How do you know that?
Isn't that a whole thing?
Yes, it is.
I don't know why.
It is.
Probably from one of you Canadians.
It probably is.
In my life.
Yep.
Okay, next one. What's the next thing you would like to see and experience and be in safely?
Another time?
Safe. Mm-hmm.
Renaissance Italy.
Great.
Uh-huh.
And one more.
Victorian England.
Great. Okay. Next one, 3 adventures that you would like to have within your lifetime.
Well, it's too late for this, but I'd like to have been kidnapped by pirates and be a cabin boy.
Great.
Like Treasure Island.
Okay. Perfect.
Maybe not kidnapped, but I run away with them.
Right.
Yeah. Cabin boy in a pirate ship.
Great.
Okay.
2 more.
Well, it would have been fun to have been a child in the first balloon. It would have been nice to have been a passenger in the Montgolfier balloon.
Oh, great.
Just the first kid, like hanging around the Frenchman and saying, hey, do you want to come up? I need some more ballast.
I love that.
That'd have been kind of a fun adventure.
Love it.
Okay.
One more.
So the first person just, okay. An adventure. Oh. Well, it'd be really fun to discover this entrance to the center of the Earth.
Ooh.
Like to discover whether there really is a civilization down there.
Love it. Great. Okay. Next category is romance/partnership/sexy times. So this is in your fantasy. It can be a character in a book, a cartoon, an animal, a person, living or dead, just a character in a movie played by an actor. Who cares? 3 individuals that in this alternate universe you would either like to just have nonstop sex with or just have a wonderful loving relationship with or any combination thereof.
So just 3 actors?
No, but like anybody. You could be like Tom Sawyer. You know what I mean? You could be that.
Well,
or you could be like
Yogi
Bear. Or you could say Brad Pitt. Or you could say, you know, Ronald Reagan circa 1960.
The sky's
the limit.
Sean Connery.
Great.
I would say The Man with the Golden Gun, Dr. No era.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what's
wrong with me. I saw 2 James Bond movies over and over and over and over because they were on like HBO, mm-hmm. I guess, when it first started or whatever. And they were Octopussy
mm-hmm.
and Never Say Never Again, which is not even
that's Roger Moore, isn't it?
No, it's Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
Octopussy is Roger Moore.
Okay.
But my understanding of Sean Connery was that he was him at that age.
Oh.
And so but people are like, oh, young Sean Connery. Beyond. I'm like, young Sean Connery? Give me Never Say Never Again, like, yeah, late 40s Sean Connery.
Oh. See, I even liked him when he was in Zardoz.
Or like The Name of the Rose. I mean, please. Fucking Indiana Jones.
Oh, and the last God. Indiana Crusade. Jones. Okay, Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones. Oh, that would be it. You know what I'd like to be? Karen Allen taking care of his wounds. Because I have a real fetish with a wounded man.
Wonderful.
Harrison Ford, or Clint Eastwood in, is it The Beguiling, when the nuns have to take care of his broken ribs?
Is he number three?
Injured Clint Eastwood. But then it's two men that are wounded.
I know, I'm laughing because I love the idea that all of them are wounded.
I would say... Idris Elba in anything, but maybe Luther, because he's such a wounded man.
I know.
Such
how many
like
how
right
many,
after he punched a hole in the wall?
How many contents of desks can he sweep off in anger?
Yeah,
a lot.
How many holes can he punch in a wall?
How would you like to be continuity on a show like that, where the main character is always destructive and like getting cuts on his face and throwing shit? Luther, fantastic.
Luther.
Okay, wonderful. Okay. Next category, three places in the world that you would like to have a little vacation getaway, if you could. And getting there is everything sort of equidistant. It's like...
Boracay in the Philippines.
Great. Next.
Findhorn in northern Scotland.
Oh. And?
Oh. And a little pied-à-terre in Paris.
Great. Paris. Pied. Fantastic. Okay, next category is three foods that in our reality either are very fattening or they give you the sugar rush, but then you feel sick afterwards, or they're incredibly rare and expensive, or you're allergic to it. Whatever your reasoning is, in this reality, that doesn't exist. All of that goes away, and you can have whatever you want, three things, at the snap of your fingers in perpetuity, and it's good for you. It doesn't even matter. It's like, oh, foie gras is good for you and the environment. Didn't you know? This is our fantasy, our food fantasy land.
Okay, so I'm going to have a main, and then...
You do whatever you want.
Well...
I like that you're establishing rules for yourself.
Well, I
don't have to eat nothing but this, but this is just what you could have.
Well, here's the thing is, I'm not like a person who like craves fattening foods.
Yeah.
I'm quite lucky that way.
Yeah. You
know, like, I like bitter things. Like I like kale.
Yeah.
And if you said my last dessert, it wouldn't be coconut cream pie. It would actually just be a mango. But I would say coconut cream pie for dessert.
Great.
Is it wrong to have, I like game.
There's nothing wrong with this. There's no.
I'm going to have wild boar.
Great. And then one last one.
Well, and then. Because I can't drink coffee.
Yep, there you go.
Because I can't handle it any longer.
This
but
is what it's for.
Yeah.
Acidic? Can't handle it because it's acidic. Yeah. I hear that. Okay, next one is a fictitious character from film, from TV, from books, three, that you would love to have as a real friend. Like, oh, Oscar Wilde's my buddy. Or, oh, Anne of Green Gables. That's
Huckleberry
my girl.
Finn.
Great.
I can't say Anne of Green Gables because that's yours.
You can have Anne of Green Gables.
No, I'm not going to. Harriet the Spy.
Great. Great.
And our third one?
Yeah.
So Huckleberry, me, Harriet. Who would be a good one? It has to be a person, eh?
No. I mean, if you say like a Rubik's Cube, I'll think you're weird.
You can't say Wilbur the Pig or anything. Or like.
No, you can. Absolutely, can say Wilbur the Pig by all means.
No, I think I'm gonna go for a character from because I've read a lot, so I'm not gonna betray my literary pretension.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not gonna choose a Virginia Woolf character,
right?
okay, Madame Bovary.
Oh, great!
Because I'm just
great.
Yeah.
She's living.
Yeah.
She's living it out and up. Okay, great. Okay. Three modes of performance that for whatever reason it's unlikely that you will get to actually maybe do, but in this sort of fantasy world, three different modes.
Number one,
yeah,
ballet dancer.
Great.
A magician.
Great. Oh my God, I would love for you to incorporate magic into everything else you already do.
I'm thinking of
it
that.
It would be amazing.
I think that'd be, so a ballet dancer, a magician, and the third one. I know, one of those living mermaids.
Great.
Yeah. In Florida. Yeah. In the 50s.
Something about just the words living mermaid are just so...
In a one piece?
It implies that that there are a lot of dead stuffed mermaids out there.
A living mermaid.
Not a taxidermied mermaid.
No.
Not one of them.
No, living.
A living.
In a tank, performing for people.
Correct.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
In a one piece.
Fantastic.
Bess Meyerson, Miss America bathing suit.
Yeah.
It's a very, very obscure
very
reference.
Very exciting for me.
Okay.
Okay. All right. And then final category. This is where I always choke up because I'm not sure how I want to end this. I feel like all my ones that I was really excited about that I came up with you know what? Let's do this. Let's do three films that you can jump into and just be with the characters. You're not reenacting the plot, but it's the world and the feeling that film gives you. Three that you can jump into whenever you want.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Great.
Clockwork Orange.
I couldn't have wanted to spend the rest of my life with Alex Moore when I was 13 years old. I was sure he was the man for me.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Me too.
I mean, it's very un-PC, but I've been very open about admitting to, like, you know, wanting to, you know, feeling like that's, like, he's for me.
The ultimate bad boy.
Yeah. I mean,
you really wanted to change a bad boy, didn't you?
Oh my God. I don't remember wanting him to change, though. Do you know what I mean? I don't remember being like, well, if I could work on him. I think it was more that, like, I personally needed permission to be as bad as him. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think it was more the attraction to being that person that I sexualized rather than, if I could just change him, you know, I would just nurture him and he would become so sweet, then you don't want it anymore. Well, so for me, it was more like I must have wanted to be out there.
How old were you when you were watching that?
13, 14.
Clockwork Orange.
Taking drugs. I wanted to, it was like, if I could just be out in the world destroying
beating
things.
Beating people up, wearing a cod piece.
Destroying things while listening to the synth version of Beethoven's Ninth, I would be set. Like, that's bliss, everybody.
Me too.
Yeah. So I'm right there with you.
I pick a third one that makes me look like not a complete psychopath. Lord of the Rings.
Great. Great, great, great. Okay, pick a number between 1 and 6.
3.
Okay. I'm going to pause this, do some very important non-mathematics. I'm going to come back and give you my 100% guaranteed fictitious MASH future.
Okay.
All right, we're going to get into these MASH results. I'm very pleased. First of all, I want to very much congratulate you on so at random you could have gotten a mansion, apartment, a shack, or a house. That's the MASH part of the mm-hmm. MASH game. You got a house,
okay,
but it also qualifies as a Parisian pied-à-terre.
Okay,
so
nice.
that's worth a pretty penny
to have a house in downtown Paris is a big deal.
Yeah.
So which arrondissement is it in?
Which arrondissement would you like it to be in?
Neuvième.
Oh, the neuvième. Félicitations, mon ami. Okay. You also, when you're like, ugh, my home in the States, ugh, my home in Paris, I got to get away from all of this. Rest assured, you can also jump to the time and place when humans, Neanderthals, and giant lizards... / soon to be birds, we're living together
wearing
on
nothing
this
but
crazy
loincloths.
Planet, nothing but a loincloth, maybe a fig leaf or two.
Maybe.
Who knows? You can do that if you want to come back to the present and have an adventure right here in this moment. Rest assured, you have the key, the secret to the entrance to the center of the earth.
Oh my God, fantastic!
Oh, I'm very
exciting.
Envious of that.
Yeah.
I'm a little angry actually.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can jump into the world of Lord of the Rings, which encompasses like three other worlds.
Absolutely.
Easy.
Yeah.
So you got a lot to work with here. And a lot of attractive species wandering around and being adorable. You also can have, and by the way, you are going to get very tired having all these adventures. I want you to rest assured you're going to have the best and most coffee you could possibly want or need. Zero ramifications. It's going to be wonderful. We also have this sort of like time that you stopped being the you that we know for a moment and had a wonderful, wonderful stint as a living mermaid.
Oh, God. Well, that was my midlife crisis.
So happy. Yeah. He was a living mermaid. Hmm? No, I said living mermaid. Yes,
from
you heard me. 41
to 44, he was a living mermaid.
I did say living mermaid. That leaves us with your relationships and your friendships, of course, shared with your buddy, Madame Bovary.
Okay. Oh, no. Talking about infidelity.
I just don't see you straying that far when you are coming home to Idris Elba's Luther.
I'm not going to be, no matter how much she talks about how that affair was good for her, I've got a good man
at
home.
Right.
Why
right.
go out for ground beef when I've got steak at home?
That's right. That's right.
Madame Bovary.
Well, sure.
Go wait for me in the pied à terre.
Yeah, you guys are going to have some spats, but it's going to be fine. You got to work it out. The last thing that I do for my Boys of Summer series, because I only interview gentlemen during the summer, it's just how it worked out, and I call it my Boys of Summer series, is that I'm spontaneously putting on you, can you think of or remember any part of Don Henley's song, Boys of Summer?
No.
Do you think you've ever heard it?
It's the Eagles?
Yeah, but it's his solo career.
Oh, I remember that.
Kind of in the era, possibly, of In a New York Minute. But this one is like the chorus is like, I can't see you, your brown skin shining in the sun. You're just shaking your head at me. You got your headphones on, sunglasses on, baby. Now you're cringing and grimacing and shaking your head at me.
I don't know what's next.
That's
the Beatles. Like, what? What are you doing? What is this?
It's just a tradition. That I've been
I know
out,
that
I
was a big
very,
song,
very
right?
Ashamed.
Boys of Summer.
Yeah, it's just a song that was on all the time for a minute for me when I was growing up. And MTV was like...
I know it was big.
Yeah.
That's the Boys of Summer.
Yep, great. Great. That's all I needed. Your version is actually more interesting.
And they're coming for you. They're not waiting for the fall. They're going to find the girls of winter. And it's all going to be spring, right?
Yeah, that's it.
And the boys of summer find the girls of winter. It's spring all the time.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you.
People can find you. Keep your eyes peeled on Earwolf, Stitcher, anywhere you listen to podcasts for Scott Thompson's podcast. We don't have an exact drop date, but we know he's already been working on them there. It will be soon. Where can they find you if they want to follow? Are you on Twitter or anything
Twitter,
like that?
Scott just so Thompson they can know underscore.
Great. Scott Thompson underscore.
Yeah.
At the end?
At the end.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
Well, do you have an underscore?
Nope.
Where's you? Where are you?
Well, a lot of people do the underscore in the middle.
Yeah, no.
I like that you tag it.
I tag.
We'll put a button on it.
Yeah.
Put that underscore button on it.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing the podcast.
Thank you, Jen. This has been wonderful.
Rest of yous. I'll talk to you next time. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.